Okay. See questions. Wow, it's amazing. Not many questions today. You must have had lots of good meditation today. Question number one. Adan, Ajahn, do you have any advice for silencing the songs in the head? Sometimes if you listen to too many songs on an iPod, sometimes they stick in your head. Because I remember once I was visiting Bangkok as a young monk. I had to stay in Bangkok to do some visas. And I was just in the room and somebody passed by with like a ghetto blaster. And this is a song which I heard. It's only maybe for 1 minute. And I couldn't get out that song out of my head for about a month. Especially being a monk, you're just so sensitive. So even here sometimes, things as you hear, can you hear okay? Is it on? Okay. It doesn't seem to be on, is it? Hello? No? Yeah, that's better, yes. Yeah. Okay. So sometimes it's so sensitive. But one thing you can do, if you've got some songs in your head, you can actually use what we call substitution. Substitute it for another song. Simon and Garfunkel, Sound of Silence. That's what happened to me once. I was at Ming's house and we're doing a fundraiser for our retreat centre. And I think it got a bit too exuberant. And so she passed me the microphone and said, Ajahn Brahm, sing a song. You're not allowed to sing a song as a monk. Out of compassion. If you heard my voice, you'd understand what I meant. So I had to get out of that very quickly. So I took the microphone and I shut up for about 1 minute. And so you're supposed to be singing. I said, yes, Simon and Garfunkel, Sound of Silence. So silencing the songs in your head. First of all, don't listen to them in the first place. But if that doesn't work, the song's already in your head. Sometimes the only thing you can do is substitute it. Like you can do the chanting instead. Or do some other little mantra which you say to yourself again. And of course you all know my favourite mantra. My favourite mantra you do along with your breathing. As you breathe in, you say the word to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up. Breathing in, shut. Breathing out, up. Shut up. Because sometimes you need something to substitute for that song which keeps on going on in your head. Because otherwise, it's amazing, just the psychology of the mind. Sometimes it's almost like an obsession. And it gets round and 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 round. So be very careful there to see if you can use a substitution method. Do something else. Like a mantra is very, very good. Or contemplate some Dhamma. Anything. Or just feel the sensations in your body. That's a very good way of shutting out the head, because then you get into reality instead of just inner thoughts in your head. Feel the sensations in the body. Maybe later on I can teach about the sweeping meditation of the body. That would be very good for stopping the songs. Because the songs, it's a mental thing, a mental obsession, and you want to get real. So get out into the feelings of the body. And that might help also. Some idea to substitute sort of the obsession with a song in your head. However, if the song happens to be like the Metta Sutta, this is what should be done. You can keep that in your head as long as you like. However, that really hasn't got a beat. That really hasn't sort of got what sort of really grabs you. Never mind. Is that okay? Anyone got any more questions about that one? Yes. Chanting. Wow, wonderful. But after a while, the chanting gets pretty boring after a while. So that should stop, shouldn't it? I don't know. Substitution is very good. But the last resort, if nothing else works, go and get a lobotomy. Next question. That's on the tape again. It's only a joke. It's not serious. So no, just in the end, so the chanting just appears. But if chanting, one of the advantages of the chanting, especially if you know what it means, it's actually very, very important Dhamma. It's very powerful, very deep. So some of the chanting which we do, especially as those monks, you know, some of the deep chanting, the sutras, are incredibly powerful. And sometimes, I remember like even just once doing like the chanting for spreading loving kindness. But because I just had a good meditation, I was following the words, it was in Pali. I got stuck, I couldn't go any further because I got so much bliss. Just the spreading loving kindness. All the other monks carried on chanting and I was just blissing out. So some of the chanting can be very, very, very powerful. So if you've got that type of chanting in your head, just go for it. Any other questions on that? Okay, this question. Dear Ajahn, is Mara an actual being? Or is it just human nature asserting itself? For those of you who know your Buddhist text, it's supposed to be this guy, and it's a guy, not a girl, Mara, who lives in this very high heaven realm. But he's always messing around with people, especially if you're meditating and getting close to Nirvana. He was the guy who just before the Buddha became enlightened, he came up to the Buddha and said, come on, Gotama, you know, just what are you getting enlightened for and just disappearing? You can do so much in the world. You can solve all the problems of the world. You can be what's it, a wheel-turning monarch. And that means you've got all this power and you can be in harmony and peace and prosperity and good health to all sentient beings. And the Buddha said, yeah, I've been there, done that. Because you know that sometimes the people who go into sort of politics or places of power, many people actually go in with the highest of motives, just like an Obama. But you know, even with the best of intentions, sometimes the system tends to corrupt you. That's why, you know, we have that saying by Lord Acton, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power corrupts absolutely. And there's one philosopher said, if that's the case, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, where does that leave God? I shouldn't say that in here. Never mind. You can understand that anyone's in a great position of power, it does corrupt you. And this being, Mara, actually got reborn in a place where the devas, the heavenly beings, actually exert their power. They get very, very powerful beings. It's called the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, the realm of those who exert power over other people's creations. So these are the people who really get off on power. If you start to look at the different pleasures available to people in the world, now we do have the pleasures of, you know, the senses, you know, sex, movies, beauty, but there's more power, there's more pleasure than that. That's why people who do get lots of wealth, they like to go into politics because they want to exert their power even more. And so power becomes like a type of pleasure which people seek, which is even more attractive and addictive than the ordinary sensory pleasures, you know, of good food or music. So this is where some beings get reborn in, the ones who aspire to have power and to enjoy the exercise of power. But that does actually corrupt you. So this being going into sort of, you know, having lots and lots of good karma, but you know, not being enlightened, still having defilements, gets into the place of power. And those little defilements which he has left get fed and grow and grow and grow when you try and control people. And of course, people who start to become, you know, peaceful in meditation or start to get close to enlightenment, that really pisses off this guy Mara, because you're going beyond his control, where he can't get at you. And because of that, that's why they say Mara is always trying to interfere with people who are trying to get enlightened. Now that's a physical type of Mara, and it gives you an understanding of the problem of too much power, too much control, which is why that when the Buddha passed away, or just before rather, people asked him, who's going to take over when you're gone? Who is going to be sort of, you know, the next in line, the leader of the Buddhism? And he sort of straight away said, no one will be. Let the teachings and the practice, let that be your teacher from here on in. And because of that very, very wise practical piece of advice, it means we never had any pope, never any archbishop, never any sort of leader of world Buddhism. Thank goodness. Because otherwise you do get corrupted. So that means that, you know, we have these, what's it called, different little areas. You can be a leader of a monastery or leader of a Buddhist society. You can never be like a world leader. If you're even leader of a monastery, these monks will tell you, very often I get outvoted. I have to ask permission if I want to do things from the Sangha. So you're not sort of fully in charge or control anyway. And that's the way it's all been set up. So we understand the danger of power. But on a deeper level, on a metaphorical Mara, the Mara is like a symbol of human nature. This is the controller inside of you. And you know, the more you try and control your life, the people around you, and even your own body and mind, the more you get corrupted. Power corrupts. And your power corrupts you. Because all power comes from the sense of self. It's me, ego, I, who really believes it can control things. And when you do that, you create craving. And when you start to crave, you want to change things, sometimes with good motives, but sometimes stupid motives. But even with good motives, you try and control things, you try and do something, what happens? You get frustrated when it doesn't work out the way you want it to. And frustration leads to anger. And sometimes anger leads to violence. Violence against yourself. Pushing yourself too hard. Not giving yourself enough rest or sleep. And it's amazing just how much violence people do to their own body, psychologically. And more than that, violence against your mind. You think you can control the meditation. It's 2 days already and you still haven't got peaceful. And sometimes you can get so aggressive to your own mind. Stupid, stupid, stupid. It's as if you're hitting yourself with a stick inside your own head. And that type of violence, it all comes because we try to control and it hurts and creates so much pain. So that's the Mara inside, the controller. And in the whole way of meditation, you can see just how I've spoken, how I've taught so far the last couple of days. We're going in a totally different direction. Letting go, doing nothing, being kind, being gentle, letting things be, letting it go. That's the complete opposite of controlling. And that scares the shit out of Mara. I don't mind using the vernacular. Because that really, you know, the Mara inside of you, the control, that's why sometimes you do get afraid in meditation. Because it's like you're losing control. Great. You never had real control anyway. It's about time you faced up to that and realized it. The older you get, the more you realize you can't control your own body. You're all old enough now to know you can't control other people. Sometimes you got married to somebody and you try to control them. You try and control your kids. You try and control the people at work. But really, you should know you can only influence them, but you can never control them. Yeah, you think you can control your own body, but you can't. The body goes according to its nature. You can only control things which you own. You don't own your kids. You don't own your partner. And certainly you don't own your body. So why do you think you can control it? Your body belongs to nature. You're just inside of it for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, that's all. It's like a rental car. It's not, you haven't got ownership on it. After 60, 70, 80 years, you've got to hand it in. This is actually, means we don't own this body. But really we think we own our mind. That's why we try and control our mind. And you all know enough Buddhism. You've all heard anatta, not me, not mine, not a self. The body, not me, not mine, not a self. The feelings, we call them Vedana, you know, pleasure and pain of all the six senses, not me, not mine, not a self, doesn't belong to me. You know, the perceptions, mental formations, thoughts even, not me, not mine, don't belong to you, they're not your thoughts, not a self. And even consciousness, the fifth khanda, these are the five khandas. Even consciousness, the Buddha said, not me, not mine, doesn't belong to you, not a self. And if we could only realize that, we'd stop controlling it. And because we try and control it, that's why we make all the suffering. When we let it go, no control, things get so peaceful. When you let things be, everything gets quiet and silent and blissful and free. The more you try and control things, the more problems you make in this world, especially in your meditation world. Which is why that's the Mara within, the control freak. And you've got to be really careful, because just like that being Mara always gets involved when you're about to get enlightened. When you're about to enter jhana, you get nimitta coming up. That's when your controller really gets involved. Playing around with the nimitta, making it this way, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. It's as if, just before you get into jhana, that your controller gets scared. You're about to move beyond control. In the sutras they say, only the jhanas is the place where Mara cannot go. Because the will can't go into those bliss states. Their will can only mess around outside, but not within. Because the will, the choice, disappears within the jhanas. So just before you get into the jhanas, in those sort of nimitta stages, that's where you've got to be very careful, because your will get so scared, it will interfere and stop you entering. And that's why people get excited or afraid. They tend to mess it up, and they're just so close. And they mess it up because they do something. All because Mara is getting afraid. Your controller inside. And also, the Buddha always used to call Mara, he called it like almost the deceiver. In other words, it tricks you into thinking this is important, this is real. If you really understand what goes on, you actually see through Mara, which is why the Mara is always conquered, not with force, but just with knowledge, with seeing, understanding. I know you, Mara. I can see you controlling. And as soon as you see it, it just fades away straight away. So all you really need to do is to understand this thing inside of you which always wants to get involved, which always wants to change things, manipulate things, control things. Once you can know that, you see it very clearly. In ordinary meditation, deep meditation, you say, I know you. And straight away it disappears. You don't need to thump it, to kick it, or to kill it, because that's more doing. That's more controlling. It's trying to control the controller. All you do is, I know you. You see it. And straight away, it vanishes. You can just let go. And that's the Mara inside of you. And it's one of the reasons why, when we got our city centre, we chose a suburb. No La Mara. You know what that means in some Malaysian. Nola and it means no. We always add this lat onto everything in Malaysia and Singapore. Okay, lah? So it means no Mara. That's why Mara can't come into that suburb. That's why we built it can, but not into our centre. That's why we built the place there. So those of you from Malaysia and Singapore understand that joke. So this is actually what Mara is, the controller. So, yeah, it's supposed to be a being. You understand why it's a being. And why it gets into trouble, because it gets into controlling and it corrupts. And that's why in all of the way the Buddha set up, like the sanghas, the monks and the nuns, he put these safeguards. It's a democratic system for the monasteries. So, I can't get my own way, even though, I've been there the longest. I can get my own way sometimes, but if I go too far, the monks will stop me straight away. I haven't got absolute control or power. And you don't want that, because it's just dangerous. And I know that in my meditation. I haven't got absolute power. I can't say, okay, get into jhana. You just have to let go, and then jhana happens. So, the idea of controlling, doing, making, craving, that's almost like what we mean by Mara. And letting go, peace, contentment, freedom, that's the opposite. That's why we do lots and lots and lots of letting go. tough to do, because it's scary. Because when you let go of control, most of what you think you are also vanishes. So it's almost like you're disappearing, you're vanishing. Because much of who we think we are is made up of our will. To let that go is scary. But you let it go little by little, and you find the more you let go of your craving and sense of control, the more peaceful and happy you become. There's many examples of that in life. You know that in these cities in the West, we have all these traffic lights. And there's always big queues, but sometimes there's a power outage and the traffic lights don't work. And when the traffic lights don't work, usually the traffic flows more freely. They don't have accidents because people are smart enough. They see it's, they can turn right or go straight ahead, they do. But you don't know how many times you've been in the traffic light and it's been red and there's no traffic coming in the opposite direction or anywhere, but you still have to wait. Well, the best example, somebody told me, in Jerusalem, I don't know how many years ago, some time ago now, all the doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. So there's still the nurses looking in the after the hospitals. In those 2 weeks, the death rate plummeted when the doctors went working. A bit scary, isn't it? But you can actually sometimes see what happens when people stop controlling these things. How many times do you go to hospitals and they do test after test after test after test after test? Gee, I mean, so they should know better than that. But anyway, sometimes when you stop controlling, things actually just get better. It's an interesting thing to know in life. Anyway, anyone want to say anything more about controlling? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. This is when the person had these distracting thoughts. And the Buddha gave all these ways of overcoming them. And the first way, substitution, was what I mentioned when the person had this music in their head. Just substitute it for something else. For the last resort, they say, clench your fist and beat it down. But that is only like a really, really last resort. Like, you know, you're thinking you want to sort of kill your favorite monk. So please don't do that. Just clench your teeth and stop. Please control those urges. So it's only like a last resort sort of thing. That's a dangerous one. It is a doing. Clenching your teeth and beating things down is a doing. It's only sort of a makeshift, just to make sure that you don't really cross the line and do something really, really stupid. But you know, it doesn't really solve the problem underneath. It will come back up again. A way of just safeguarding your body and speech until something else can happen. It's not a method for calming the mind in meditation, unless you're really going crazy. And even that just makes you more crazy when you try and beat down the mind. Not to be recommended. It's only if you're doing something really, really stupid physically. Okay, the next question. To what extent is energy, effort, concentration and wisdom implied in mindfulness? Can mindfulness exist on its own without these factors? Oh, you know my old story about mindfulness. This is a bit of a cheeky joke. But sometimes people who teach Vipassana teach it's the only way. And so because they're cheeky, I'll always go cheeky back. So, once upon a time, there was a very wealthy lady who came to the temple to listen to a Dharma talk. But before she left her mansion to go to the temple, she told the guard, because wealthy people have guards in the front of their house, she told the head guard, I'm going to the temple this evening, and there are many burglars around this city, so I want you to be mindful. You must be mindful. And so the guard said, yes, madam, I will be mindful all evening. Very good. So So she goes to the temple. Here's a wonderful Dhamma talk. And when she goes back, she found the burglars have been in the house and stolen all her possessions. And she goes to her guard. I thought I told you to be mindful, you stupid guard. You weren't mindful. And he said, but madam, I was mindful. What do you mean you were mindful? Well, I noticed the burglars going in. I was very mindful. I even noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. And then I was very mindful as they came out. Jewelry going out with burglars, jewelry going out with burglars, jewelry going out. And I noticed them going in again. Burglar going back in, burglar going in. I noticed, you know, the safe going out, safe going out. I was very mindful. I saw everything. Now, of course, that's a very stupid, guard. But it's not just being mindful. Whatever you see, sometimes you've got to take responsibility. So, a really good guard of the house, if you see the burglars about to go in, you try and put energy and effort to stop them. Ringing the police. Or just, you know, locking the house, or whatever. So it's the effort to stop unwholesome things coming into your mind. If, you know, for somehow or other the burglars go in the back way and you see them in the house, then you've got a responsibility. If you're mindful, you notice the burglars are actually already in the house, then you've got to put some sort of effort in to get rid of them. And that's actually where you really call the police. There's burglars in the house already. Come quickly to arrest them. But you know, one of the best ways of keeping out burglars from your house is to have somebody stay in your house when you're away. So sometimes the guard, say, invites, you know, the owner's relations or friends, or maybe some of his own friends, you know, in the house. Because when you've got your own good people in the house, the burglars can't get in. So that's, you know, when you're away, putting effort into establish wholesome qualities in your mind. If you've got wholesome qualities in the mind, the bad ones just can't find a way in. And lastly, and sometimes you may have, you know, the owner's brother and sister there, but to keep them there so they don't leave before the owner comes back. So that's the effort to maintain the wholesome qualities there. Invite them in, but keep them there. And those are the Buddha's four right efforts, which always has to go along with mindfulness. So those four right efforts, you know, of keeping out the unwholesome and establishing wholesome or good qualities inside the mind, that's actually the goal of effort. But actually, how do you do that? How do you establish good and wholesome things inside the mind? And really it is the effort to let go. And let go of your craving, because you are the burglar. You're the one who destroys all the peace and happiness. It's not some sort of bad people coming from without. It's actually you're the problem. And so what you have to do is have the effort to keep you from interfering with the process. So you put your guard on the mind. Okay, no controlling, no interfering, no sort of messing up the process. And of course, once you get some really beautiful states of mind established in there, which is why that sometimes, and I think yesterday or the day before, I said, imagine the most peaceful experience you've ever had in your mind, in your life. Imagine it. Fill in the details. Spend about 5 minutes painting the picture. And then, when the picture disappears, you'll still have the peace. You've actually established a wholesome quality inside your mind from the very beginning. So any of the distractions, such as thoughts or negativity, they can't come in because you've already got peaceful stuff inside. Little things like that are very, very helpful to establish wholesome qualities in the mind. But the best way and the most stable is to do lots and lots of letting go and lots of peacefulness, because that establishes the most wholesome quality of all: the peace, the calm, the joy. So it is the right effort. But the most powerful right effort is the effort to say no, to stop, to be still. Which is not the effort to keep doing things, but the effort to stop doing things. If you understand that, you understand a lot about what Buddhism really is. We had that simile in the story of the enlightenment of the Buddha. When it was supposed to be actually at Bodh Gaya on the Nirantala River, which runs right past Bodh Gaya for those of you who've been on pilgrimage there. It's just a little brook, a stream now, it's not exactly like a big river like it used to be. At least every time I've been there, it's just a little trickle. But anyway, according to the story, before the Buddha became enlightened, he got his bowl and put it in the stream and made a resolution. If I'm going to go get enlightened, may my bowl flow against the current, go upstream instead of downstream. And it did. And that was supposed to be like a sign, an omen, that he would become enlightened. But I often thought about that. It's much more than an omen. It also shows how to get enlightened, to go against the stream, as the Buddha later said, of craving, of doing, of wanting. And that's one of the hardest things to do. We always go with the stream of craving, wanting, controlling. And the Buddha said, no, go against that stream. Not doing, not craving, not wanting, stopping. That's a hard thing to do. But little by little, if you hang out here long enough, you'll get the hang of it. And that's the best effort. And of course, that's where the wisdom comes in, because you know exactly what the effort is, you know what the wholesome states are, and you know exactly where and how to arouse the energy. Energy is not generated through effort in meditation. Physical energy comes from effort. Mental energy comes from stillness. I remember Ajahn Chah saying that. So if you want to have a strong body, exercise it. If you want to have a strong energetic mind, keep it still. The more still you are, the more powerful your mind becomes. If you work the mind, think it, then it actually is quite weak compared to the power of a still mind. So if you want energetic mind, keep it still. Over the next few days, you'll find there are moments when your mind is very powerful, but poised. It's not the power of a tiger, which is just poised, they're waiting, full of energy. It's not like running around like a monkey. You've got monkey energy, and you've got like tiger energy. You know which is more powerful. Monkeys can never sit still. That's why we call it the monkey mind. And we've got that story of the monkey mind. So I like telling stories later in the evening. Those of you who come to all my retreats, you're going to hear these stories every retreat. And that's, you know what's going to happen. That's your fault. Once upon a time, in Sri Lanka, there was a monk giving the talk during the they call it Poya days, the one praj, the time when you have lots of people coming to the temple. And he was talking about meditation, and he mentioned the monkey mind. And the monkey mind, you've probably all heard about monkey mind, the mind jumping here, jumping there, being all over the place. And obviously, in meditation, a monkey mind is not a good mind to have. You're not still, you're really restless, jumping from one thing to the other, just like the monkeys jump from one tree to another. And as it happened, a monkey was actually visiting the temple, not to listen to the Dharma, but because people bring a lot of food on that day, and he thought he might find a banana or a mango somewhere and steal it. And when he was looking for something to eat, he happened to hear this monk start talking about monkey mind, monkey mind. So he got interested. Oh, that's my mind. What's he talking about? And the monkey heard this priest say, monkey mind is bad, it's terrible, you shouldn't have a monkey mind, you go crazy, you have a monkey mind. And the monkey got quite offended. So what's wrong with a monkey mind? What's this priest saying a monkey mind is bad for? I'm not standing for this. I've got my rights and my feelings. And he got really angry. And this monkey immediately swung back into the forest and told the head of his monkey troop, you wouldn't believe what the monks say about us. They say, our mind is terrible, it's bad, it's stupid. We can't stand for that. And all the other monkeys agreed with him. They started jumping up and down. Yeah, we should do something. We should get a lawyer and sue this priest for defamation. You can't say that monkey minds are bad. That's just too much generalization. Who do these lay people think they are? And these monks think they are. They can defame us like this and say bad words about monkeys. This is unfair in our modern age. And they were jumping up and down when the head of the monkeys said, stop. You see, that's what he's talking about. That's the monkey mind jumping up and down and getting upset and angry. And all the monkeys had a bit of insight. Said, oh, yeah, that's true. Monkey mind is not a good mind. And then they said, well, how can we stop our monkey mind? And so the head of the group of monkeys said, well, I've also been to the temple. And the head monks, the priests there, say, if you meditate, you can calm down the monkey mind and have a good mind instead of a monkey mind. So all the monkeys started jumping up and down, yeah, let's meditate, yeah, let's meditate. And the head monk said, well, that's not how you meditate. Sit down, for goodness sake. But before they sat down, they had to get a little cushion. So they all went up into the forest and all got some leaves and some grass and made little cushions for themselves in the clearing. They all sat down. Now what do we do? Now what do we do? Now what do we do? Almost jumping up and down again. They said, now you've got to cross your legs. So they all cross their legs. Put your left hand down and your right hand in front of the left hand. Put your backs up straight, heads down, close your eyes and watch your breath. So all these monkeys, you've never seen so many monkeys be still for about 3 seconds. Then one of the monkeys put his hand, excuse me, excuse me. And all the monkeys very happily opened their eyes. What, because they're already getting bored. Excuse me, don't you remember that today we all plan to go and raid the local banana plantation for lunch? And it's only about an hour for lunch. Why don't we, because I've been thinking about this, why don't we go and raid the banana plantation first of all? We won't eat yet. We'll put all the bananas, you know, in a sort of a heap in front of us to get it out of the way. Let's get it out of the way first of all, because it's been bothering me. And all the monkeys said, yeah, great idea, good idea. So all the monkeys got up from their little meditation cushions. They all swam to the banana plantation. They stole many, many bananas. They didn't eat it yet, because that was the agreement. And they put all the bananas in a big pile so they could get it out of the way, and now they could meditate. So they all went back to the little cushions, sat down, left hand, right hand on top, back straight, heads down, closed eyes, watching the breath. Another 3 seconds. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys. Excuse me, I've been thinking, he said. You know, before we eat the bananas, we've got to peel them. So why don't we get that out of the way first of all? Let's peel all the bananas and then we can meditate, because this has been obsessing me. You know, how am I going to peel my bananas? So all the other monkeys said, yeah, great idea, good idea. So they all jumped off of their cushions and peeled all the bananas. They never ate it yet. They just peeled all the bananas, put them in a big heap, and once they peeled all the bananas and got that out of the way so they didn't have to think about that, then they all went back to their cushions, sat down, left hand, right hand on top, back straight, head down, closed eyes, watching the breath. Excuse me, said another monkey, I've been thinking. You know, before we eat the bananas, they're already peeled, before we eat them, we've got to put them in our mouths. So why don't we get it out of the way first of all? Good idea, they said. But we won't eat it, we'll just put it in our mouth. So when the meditation is finished, we'd rather have to worry about doing that. Get it out of the way, then I can meditate. So they all got out there and got a banana each and put it in their mouth. They didn't eat it, and some monkeys put two, one put three in their mouth. You know what monkeys are like. And with monkeys with bananas in their mouth, they sat down, left hand, right on top, eyes closed, and when everyone closed their eyes, of course they munched all the bananas. And that was the end of the meditation. And that's what a monkey mind is all about. Let's get this out of the way first of all, and then I meditate. Have you got a monkey mind? So now you know what monkey minds are. So that's a nice little fun story. Okay, so you have to have a bit of a wisdom and effort to stop all of that. To stop all that restlessness. And that's the effort to stop. Any comments about that? Okay, next question. Can you see an imitator if you can still feel your body and or hear sounds? I have 5 senses not shut down. Yeah, you can, but the nimitta will not be that stable yet. If you want to know how this works, this is another little framework for understanding. You've got 6 senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind sense. Most human beings, the 5 senses are so dominant, they're way up here, and the mind sense is so soft and weak, it's dominated by the five external senses. You see, you hear, you smell, you taste, much more than actually you know. But when you start meditating, you suppress the power of the five senses, and you increase the power of the sixth sense, the knower. You increase your mindfulness, the knowing, not the doing, just the knowing. And soon, you know, the power of the mind gets so strong, it's actually stronger than the five senses. Which means that some of you, if you really meditate deeply and really get some good meditation, you go to lunch and you can see a nimitta in front of you, in front of the food. You've got to sort of almost like eat the food through the nimitta. And sometimes this is because the mind at this time is incredibly strong. Now that's when you really get into some powerful meditation for long periods of time. The nimitta's there right in front of you all the time, you know, even you're walking down the road. But that's when you get very, very strong meditation. But when you get sort of starting getting reasonably strong meditation, that nimitta can come up very easily. So you can still feel the body and know the breath, but the nimitta is right there waiting for you. Just because your mind is very, very strong. But nevertheless, it's still a good idea to actually to calm down those five senses until the nimitta becomes really, really strong, and then it can take you into the jhanas. So yes, it can, nimitta can be perceived while you've still got hearing sounds, feeling the body, even with your eyes open, sometimes you can see that. However, it's usually the best thing is keep your eyes closed, restrain the senses, and then that nimitta will become more powerful. So it can be done, but it's not such a good idea. Any comments on that?
In that context, I think this is a very dumb question, but...
No, no.
How do you restrain the senses?
How you restrain the senses, in other words, you close your eyes, and you don't bother about sounds outside of you. So people move, that's their business. You don't sort of worry about those sounds and the feelings in the body, you just calm the body down, sit comfortably, and then just let it go. That's what we mean by restraining the senses. You don't bother with sounds or feelings. You get the body as comfortable as it possibly can. It'll never be totally comfortable. No one's ever designed a chair, you know, which makes you absolutely comfortable for such a long time. Except maybe the electric chair. So you have to go through a bit of pain before you get that comfort. Yeah, they don't. No. So whatever you do, you know, you can't get the most comfortable place. That's why sometimes you see, I love it in meditation retreats, to see the latest design for chairs or meditation seats. And it's amazing innovation in the West. You know, if you look at some of these Buddhist books or Buddhist magazines from the United States, it's amazing the sort of meditation stools you can buy these days. Really high tech. You know, it's padded. I think there's one I can't remember now, there's one I saw, it was just amazing, just the amount of technology in just the meditation stool. You could actually press a button, you can move the angle, or raise it, or lower it down. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, go on.
That's
right, yeah. That's right. That's right, yeah. That's what it is, just letting the senses be. So not indulging them, not sort of changing them or worrying about them. Just leaving them alone. And then they just disappear. Yeah.
Is it okay to shift the body around?
Yeah, it's okay to shift the body around. It's very good to shift your body around. Because sometimes what happens, you're meditating, you're getting quite peaceful. This is like an ache in your knee. And sometimes people think, no, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to beat it down. I'm going to control this. Usually what happens is that the pain gets worse and worse, and you waste minutes, maybe the whole meditation. And all you really need to do is just very mindfully and very carefully just change your posture. With your eyes closed, it takes about 30 seconds. And when you've moved your posture, the pain's disappeared. You've usually gone backwards maybe 3 or 4 minutes in your meditation. You've lost ground, but you soon gain that ground back again. So you don't have to worry about that, but if you don't change, usually you just can't go any further. And you go backwards. Sometimes, that's usual, that's 99% of the time, but sometimes people can actually sit through that pain and actually, you know, it's a weird thing what happens, sometimes the pain just disappears. However, that is not recommended, even though it can happen. Sometimes it disappears, but other times you have to go to the hospital afterwards. It's just too dangerous. Anyway, if no, then if you accidentally make a sound in the meditation hall, you can't disturb someone out of nimittas and jhanas because they can't hear anything. Right. So I can feel less bad about making noise. Yeah, you don't need to feel bad about making noise because if you have a nimitta, sometimes that they can hear you. But anyway, you know, Ajahn Chah's great teaching when we were meditating in Thailand, in the northeast, and when they have a party, they have big party for 3 days without stop sometimes. Actually, they do stop. They usually stop about 2 o'clock and have a rest, and when they wake up, start all over again. But those monasteries in Thailand, you used to get up at 3 o'clock, and there was no sleeping in. You had to get up at 3 o'clock. So when the party stopped at 2, you only had an hour to get some rest, and that was not enough. On those parties, those are the days they just invented the ghetto blasters and big amplifiers, and so they're very easy to hire them from town. And so when they had a party, you could hear the music as if it was right inside your own hut, even though it's over a kilometer away. So really disturbing. So this used to happen many times. We, the Western monks in this monastery, would go and tell the headman, look, no, look, we do need a bit of rest. You know you need to party. Can you stop at 1 o'clock or something? Give us a couple of hours at least. But they didn't listen to us. So we met together and thought, let's go and ask Ajahn Chah, because they won't listen to us, but Ajahn Chah, the great monk who they're afraid of and they respect so much, surely they will listen to him when we ask him to, you know, cut down the noise. So we went to see him, and we didn't get what we wanted. We got something much better. And he told us, what are you talking about? It's not the noise disturbing you. You are disturbing the noise. And when he said things like that, you know, wow, this guy just understands life much more than you do. And it was. It was just noise, that's all. But we were disturbing it. We're saying, no, we don't want that noise. Why should there be a noise? We were making more noise in our head. There was noise coming out of the amplifiers. And that was the problem. And when he heard that, it just solved not just the problem of people having parties, it solved the problem of people making noise when you're meditating. Somebody gets up, they cough, they rattle bags or whatever else they do. It's not the noise disturbs you. You disturb the noise. You go out there and just make a big deal about it. They shouldn't be making this noise. No, we should get like a gun and shoot anybody. Just the first person as a warning. If they make noise again. Or you should banish them. You know, 3 strikes and you're out. If you make noise the third time, the third cough, that's it. Go back home. That reminds me of that joke. Yeah, my old jokes. The old joke about the couple who've been married for 50 years and they got interviewed by Time magazine. And the Time magazine interviewed her and said, sort of, how come you've lasted together for such a long time? And the man said, because I never argue. We haven't had an argument at all. I said, how come you can have be living together, husband and wife, and never having an argument? And the man said, this is why. Just after we got married, we went to the Grand Canyon for our honeymoon. And the first day after we got married, we went, descended down the Grand Canyon with donkeys. And my wife was ahead, and I was behind. And her donkey stumbled. And my wife said to the donkey, that's the first time. I didn't know what she was on about. But a minute or two later, the donkey stumbled again. And my wife said to the donkey, and that's the second time. And you know, a few minutes later, the donkey stumbled on a stone a third time. And this time my wife never said anything. She just got out a gun and she shot the donkey dead. And after she did that, I asked my wife, why did you do that? And my wife said, that's the first time. It's an old joke, but it's a good one. That's why I never had any arguments. That's why you don't disturb the noise. The noise doesn't disturb you. You can't disturb life. People make noises. If it's not the people, it's some aircraft goes overhead. Or you know, someone gets the lawnmower out to mow the lawn. There's always something. Just don't disturb it. Just let it go. Make peace. And then it disappears. There we go. By making peace, do you mean one should infuse all thoughts with loving kindness, skillful and unskillful ones? That's one way of doing it. It's just giving it loving kindness. But making peace is just, it's like with the noise. Don't disturb the noise. The noise is natural. So don't shout at the noise inside of your head. Don't shout at other people for coming and going. You know, don't sort of disturb my bad jokes. It just, that's my nature, that's all. You should know that by now, the number of times you've come here. So you don't get disturbed by things. It's just the nature of things, and you just let it go. So something outside disturbs your pain in the body, a noise outside, or something else. Not disturbing and making peace with it means you just allow nature to be. You don't fight nature and try change it to be just right for you. That's why that story in the book about perfection and the garden, that's where we were sitting outside for interviews. There's leaves and bark all over the place. Sometimes it's not a perfect garden. You can never play golf on it. There's too much stuff on the ground there. But to me, that's perfect enough. What about your meditation? Is it perfect enough yet? Or are you disturbing your meditation? Trying to make it something other than it is. Make peace with it. And this meditation right now is perfect enough. You'll find then the meditation just takes off. You get deep, peaceful, blissed out. You think it's not perfect. You want to make it different. Then you're controlling again. So make peace with your mind by seeing it's perfect exactly as it is. So you're now going to ask a perfect question. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether other people have this experience, but occasionally I've gone through periods where it really, if I moved every time I've got a pain,
yeah,
I would be like moving every
second there. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter how I see, and this doesn't mean I can go and get a chair. It's like there's something happening in my body telling me, so really I don't know how to make.
Oh yeah, you know that sometimes there are some feelings which, you know, that they're always coming up, and just if you scratch them, it'll just itch them more. So those types of feelings, you know, from your wisdom, that they don't really need to be moved. I just allow them to be. Don't try and get rid of them.
How do I make that judgment call that it's time? Because one of them, for sure, is going to get really bad.
Okay, well, you can do a little method which I sort of developed for myself. If I get like a feeling in the body which is irritating me, for the first time I just let it be and just go back to my breath. If it comes up and disturbs me a second time, I just go back to the breath a second time. I just ignore it. If it comes a third time, then I pay attention to it. I use that as my meditation object. Stay with that feeling.
And
meditation object, yeah. So you're just with that feeling.
Good. Tell
the
story about the lady with the gun.
No. That's only a joke. That's not a good Buddhist joke either. We don't kill donkeys. Anyway, no. So you go to the feeling and just make that your meditation object. And a lot of times, you know, you're kind to it, just allowing it to be. It usually just disappears. If it doesn't disappear, and you get the feeling come up, I can't stand this any longer. First time that feeling comes up, just ignore it. Just try to just be peaceful with the feeling. Second time it comes up, I just ignore that. For the third time, I can't stand this any longer. Then I move.
Right. Okay.
So that gives like a nice middle way.
A
a little rule of thumb. So you don't move straight away, but then you don't say, I'm never going to move. So usually, no, three is a lucky number in Buddhism. We always do things in threes, three bows, three this, three that. So because of that, you got to do it three times. That's a nice practical way. That's actually how you make peace. Through another question. After 10 or 15 minutes of meditation, my body fills up with an immense heat. What causes this? Is it normal? There's one important thing. You should never meditate on a flame. Because it burns your backside. That's an old meditation joke. But, no, actually, where that heat is coming from, a lot of times, it could be two reasons. Sometimes, if it's outside, you've been active, you know, walking, driving, or doing things, and then you suddenly sit down, your metabolism is already creating a lot of energy. And when you stop, it's like you park your car and turn the engine off. There's still a lot of heat which has to dissipate. So sometimes, if you've actually been active, maybe just working in the kitchen or something, or doing walking meditation, you sit down, there will be some heat coming up in the beginning. So if it's that beginning heat, that's just natural. Just the metabolism hasn't really slowed down yet, but you have slowed down. So it's got excess heat. However, if the heat comes up in the middle of the meditation, now that's more interesting, because that usually means you're getting relaxed. And what's actually happening, very often, this could be this person, I say this every retreat, and it always happens, when you really let go and relax, then energies can start to flow in your body. And much of that heat can be healing energy. Here, a couple of years ago, at the interview, a lady came up and said that she was meditating and just her whole back from her shoulders and neck got really hot during her meditation. It was so spooky, she came and saw me and said, what the heck is going on? And because I've had experience for such a long time teaching and practicing meditation, straight away I said, when did you have your whiplash car accident? And I thought, you can read minds. I always thought you could read minds, that's your problem. And I said, no, I'm just, no, two and two make four. It's just reason, logic. I haven't read your mind. And it was true. She had whiplash a few months ago. And I said, what's happened? Because you've let go, you've relaxed the body. It did come when she was very peaceful. Now the energies of your body have a chance actually to get to those places and heal them. I said, you probably feel just really relaxed. He said, yeah, I feel so good. I haven't felt good in that area for months. And that's what happens. And there's many times that happens in meditation, especially on these 9-day retreats. You're sitting there and you're getting very peaceful and calm and still. And you get huge amounts of heat. It's like a fever, but it's only in one part of the body. And there's usually something as injury there or some incipient disease is coming up there. And because you're very still and peaceful, the energies can actually reach there. The other weird thing I've seen here on these retreats, because sometimes I get up early, I remember seeing this one thing with the lady. She was just screwed up in her meditation. Her posture was just something you'd think that they use in Guantanamo Bay for torturing people. And I was really concerned about her, the way she was twisting her body. And then I asked her afterwards in interviews, did you know how you were sitting? And she said, actually, that was, it was just so peaceful, and I felt so good afterwards. And I could, now first I thought, that's really weird. Now, sure, she'd be in great pain, but what had happened, she had had an injury, an accident. And I figured out that when you really let go, the body tells you how to sit. And the body was having to do this, you know, to twist her body around, to allow the energies actually to go, to unblock, you know, the results of that accident, which meant some healing could happen. So if you really get still and peaceful, now you may start with a straight back, but sometimes you go all over the place. And you feel so nice afterwards. You don't feel, you know, what you'd expect people to have all aches and pains. The body knows what to do. When you let it go, you just go and watch your breath and allow the body to look after itself. It does these amazing things like twisting itself. Sometimes people get jerks. It's just energy flows opening up. This just happens naturally because the body knows how to heal itself when you are not getting involved. So that heat could possibly be just a healing in the body, because you're being relaxed. If it is that, well done, because you know, you've done a huge amount of therapy for your physical health. If the nuns of Dhammasara can become enlightened with just 10 precepts, why do we need fully ordained bhikkhunis and bhikkhus and bhikkhunis? We could just have 10 precept monks and nuns. Really, there's very little difference between the 10 precepts and all the other precepts. And if all monks especially kept the 10 precepts, that would be wonderful, because the 10th precept is not accepting or using any money. And you know, you've been around, how many monks and nuns, especially monks, there's not that many nuns around anyway, but how many monks actually don't even keep the 10th precept? Because they have bank accounts, and they have credit cards which they use for themselves, and they have heaps of money in the bank, and they accept money. So, really, that we, if we're going to become bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, we should become good bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and not sort of keep our precepts. And the other most important precept is, you know, not sort of having any sex. It's sex and money which make the difference between a monk and a lay people. So as long as we keep those two rules, and keep them very well, then of course they're good monks and nuns. So why become a bhikkhu? Why become a bhikkhuni? I mean, because the full ordination, it gives you more restraint rules. Sure, you can become enlightened. You become enlightened as lay people. In the same way, yes, you can actually walk to Sydney. But you know, I'd advise you to get the aircraft, because it's not that expensive these days, and it's much less hassle. So yeah, you can actually get on a bicycle to Sydney. But if the aircraft is there, you know, the bhikkhus and bhikkhuni path, why not become a bhikkhu and bhikkhuni and go the way which the Buddha suggested and made, because it's the most convenient. It's not the question of why should you become a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. I like the question, why not? In other words, I throw the question back at you. How why did Ajahn Chah make monks sit in group sittings and meditation for long periods of time? Wouldn't this make him a control freak? A really good question, that one. Now how can I get out of this one? There was sometimes in Thailand, especially this was the northeast of Thailand, and it was more Laotian than actually Thai. And the Laotians were notoriously lazy. And it's basically that Ajahn Chah, when he first started teaching, he wouldn't actually have many meetings, or hardly any meetings at all. The monks would just, here's your heart, off you go. But then when he started seeing the monks being so lazy, if he didn't actually have a meeting, they wouldn't do anything, they'd just sleep all day. So that's what, to understand like the Laotian character, I mentioned this to a lady on Friday night. This was told to me by one of my friends. He was an English guy who lived in Laos before the Vietnam War, right throughout the war, and afterwards, and then maybe about 4 or 5 years after the communists took over, he left and came to Thailand and became a monk. And so he told all these amazing stories about what happened in the war between the government and the communists in Laos. He was living in the second city, Luang Prabang, and one day he was having lunch, you know, in the cafe, you know, bamboo thatch, you know, just like you see in the remote areas. Very, very simple, but really delicious food. So he was having his lunch there. He did notice on another table were the government troops. Now they were having their lunch. They had their guns, their M16s, against the wall while they're having their lunch. Now imagine how he felt when he saw the communist troops come in with their guns. He almost made a dive under the table, because this was war, the communists and the government. And the communist troops had come into the same restaurant. But all the communist troops did, they went to another table. They put their guns against the wall and ordered their lunch. Because in Laos, even during a war, lunch is more important than fighting. And he said they made an agreement who would go first. And whoever went first would go left, and whoever went second would go right, so they wouldn't meet each other. Because that's actually the Laotian. I mean, They can't even fight wars properly, seriously. Lunch is much more important. And the other story, remember him telling me, that just after the communists took over, you know, they were very happy he could stay there. You know, he's an English man, he's married to an American girl. And they're very happy because he'd been there for a long time. They liked his character, you know, because he was the easygoing, just like the Laotian people, and he could speak the language fluently. But a few weeks after the communists took over, he found a young boy in the house, burgling the house. And you know, because the communists were there was no police, he didn't know what to do. He managed to catch the thief. And being like an English guy, you know, brought up in a public school, he just put him over his knee and spanked him, you know, as a punishment. But the boy reported that to the major, the communist, who was the head of this district. And so this, my friend, got summoned to see the major. He said he was terrified. You know, he'd broken some rule, and there's all sorts of rules, and that communist major could do anything to him. And so when he fronted up at the major's office, almost shaking, the major sort of lambasted him, so you can do that in England maybe, but you can't do that now. This is communist. We've taken over. And because of what you've done, I have to punish you. And he's braced himself. What's the punishment going to be? And the major said, you, Englishman, you have got to pay for a 3-day party for the whole district. And he said, okay, yeah, I can do that. So they had a 3-day party, and he had to pay for all the alcohol, all the food, and all the entertainment, everything. And that was a punishment. In other words, the major, they were just, you know, giving me a little bit of a slap on the wrist, but like the guy, and they all wanted a party. And this was just an excuse to get the rich Englishman to pay for everything. So that's what Laos was like, and you know, I'm not quite sure what it's like now. But they don't take too many things that seriously. So they're very lazy, you can understand that. So being Laotians, Ajahn Chah had to have these meetings just to get them to do anything. So I think that's why he did that. Okay, next question. During sitting meditation, are we aiming to pay attention to the breath from the outset? Now, don't go on to the breath straight away, because if you go on too fast the breath, you're not ready for the breath. You have to control it and force it to hold it. So just do some just gentle settling the mind down, first of all. Be calm, be peaceful. Establish mindfulness, first of all, so your mindfulness is strong enough and bright enough to be able to watch the breath. If not, how do we know when we start paying attention to just the breath? Sometimes if you do this just being in the present moment, being silent, being kind, being gentle, the breath actually comes to you. And that's how I meditate, and I've taught that to other people. They like that too, because it happens. They just relax, rest, and get my body in a nice posture, just be in the present moment, and they get silent, and they're nice and calm, making peace, being gentle. Mindfulness starts to get strong and the breath comes to you. When the breath comes to you, that's the very best. Because it's always very nice then. So that's the best. And which part of the breath? The whole in breath and the whole out breath, or just where it enters and leaves the nostrils? Or where it touches the skin near the entrance of the nostril? What about where it turns around from being out breath to in breath, outside of the nostrils? Does not matter where you watch the breath. The Buddha never taught nose meditation. He taught breath meditation. So for people who start meditation, it's very easy for me to teach them because they haven't been confused by many other explanations. All I do, I tell them to close their eyes and count 3 breaths, in, out, three times. At the end of the 3rd breath, open their eyes. And everybody can do that. And then I ask them, how did you know you were breathing in? How do you know the out breath had just ended? And a new one had come, and a 2nd out-breath, a new in-breath, and a 3rd out-breath, so you could open your eyes. How did you know that? And then they actually focus their attention, you know, using memory, and they actually know the feeling of the breath. And it can be anywhere, as long as you know the breath is going in, or it's finished going in, it's going out. Anyone can do that. That's what you watch. Whatever it is that tells you the breath is going in, or the breath is going out. Whatever that feeling is, wherever it's located. Problem comes if you start to watch the tip of the nose. Sometimes the breath's not there. It's, you know, it's being felt somewhere else, so you're watching it where it's not. In the same way, I'm sure that many people today try to find Ajahn Brahm in Bodhinyana Monastery. Well, I'm not there, I'm here. So if you want to find me, you've got to find me where I am. Just like the breath. I know I'm supposed to be in the monastery, but I'm not. Sometimes I'm in Japan, sometimes in Frankfurt, you're all over the place these days. So, you know, I've got a website now, where is Ajahn Brahm? So I can find out where I am. So it's like having a website, where is your breath? And sometimes it's up here, next minute it's down there, sometimes in your tummy. So wherever it happens to be, that's where you have to watch. So you don't have to actually even look, you know, this part of the body, that part of the body. You just know, am I breathing in or out? I can know that. That's much more helpful. That way you can always watch the breath. It's always happening somewhere. If you can't find the breath at all, then I think we should call the ambulance because you're probably dead. Okay. In deep meditation, just the breath actually focuses on one point. Because I've been doing this, just watching the breath wherever it happens to be for such a long time. I don't care where it's located. So I just know the breath is going in. I don't have any perception of where that's being experienced. But I know I did some experiments. I like playing around. When I started getting very deep, just before the breath disappeared, I remember interrupting and just asking myself, where is the breath located now? And it was located at the tip of the nose. For me anyway, when it gets very still, that's where it locates. It locates there by itself. I don't force it there. I don't even pay my attention there. The breath goes there and I follow where the breath is. So that's in deep meditation, that's what happens. But in real deep meditation, the breath disappears. And that's the best. Was that finished that question? Okay. What is the best way to be mindful when lying in bed resting, ready to go to sleep? Attention on the breath, body sensation, or if the mind's busy, thoughts? When you're laying in bed, most of you will go to sleep very easily because, you know, you've been working hard, maybe tired. But if you can't go to sleep, there's a number of ways of just being mindful when you are in bed. Doing the letting be, making peace, is by far the best. Just let things be. You're not trying to go to sleep. You're not trying to stay awake. You sit there and just let be. Let it go, let it go, let it go. Then you're gone. If you're letting go meditation, not controlling, not doing anything at all, that's one of the best ways of going to sleep. Other ways, the same type of letting go is like doing some loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. May all my fellow meditators, my teachers, the monks, the nuns, may all the people working in the kitchen be happy and well. May all the people singing in the church today be happy and well. May all the people in the whole world be happy and well. May I be happy and well. It's beautiful, wonderful, joyful metta mind. And that's great to go to sleep with a metta mind. If that doesn't work, you can do this wonderful relaxing your body meditation. Now I start with my toes. You experience the feelings in the toes, you relax them. Relax to the max. Your feet, relax to the max. You feel the whole feet just sort of expanding and relaxing. And your legs, you've been walking meditation or you've been sitting and they're aching. You just literally allow everything just to open out and relax. It's not a controlling, it's actually stopping the controlling of those parts of the muscles in those parts of the body. It's like relaxing the whole body, just sweep the body upwards. Whenever I've tried that, you know, I never get to my bottom and I'm fast asleep. Because a lot of times you get tense in the body and that's one of the reasons why you can't go to sleep. So just relax everything. And you become quite skilled at relaxing parts of the body. And so when you go to sleep, your body is completely relaxed. And it's very easy to go to sleep through that. It's much better than counting sheep. Unless you're an accountant. I often have very intense bodily sensations that make it difficult to go to sleep. I observe them, but sometimes hard to be equanimous. Any suggestions? Okay, I think I've answered that one. Do the sweeping of the body and relaxing with kindness as you go along. And there is, it's amazing just how much you can relax body. It just means that you just have to train yourself to look at a muscle. And, you know, you learn by feedback, because you notice the sensations, you know, say in your calf, and you can do something with your mind. It is a bit of controlling or suggesting, and you can actually see those feelings change. You know what you need to do to relax. It's just a bit of kindness, loosening, expanding, those sorts of thoughts, to relax your muscles. And if you practice like that with mindfulness, after a while you learn how to relax parts of your body. You can relax anything. And when you relax parts of the body, you know, through an act of choice, it's wonderful just how free and easy you can feel at any time. It's great when you go to bed, because then you can really relax parts of the body, just at will. Next question. Is there a method of walking meditation where the movement of the foot and the breath is coordinated? That is, with the in-breath you lift the foot, with the out-breath you put it down. I'm not able to do this. Sometimes people try that. I don't really like doing that myself, because I'm like split, and a half of me is watching the feet and a half of me is watching my breath. And sometimes, you know, the breath, you know, so if you're short of breath and you have to walk very quickly, and that makes you even more short of breath. So sometimes it doesn't sort of make too much sense to me. So if you watch the breath, watch the breath. If you watch your feet, and try and divide the mind. That's what I would suggest. So I've never been able to do that, so I don't really recommend it. What is consciousness? Consciousness is what's listening to me now. But that's only just the first experience of what consciousness is. Later on during this retreat, maybe I'll talk about the deep insights when you find your consciousness vanishing. People think that the consciousness is something solid, that it's really you. Maybe the will might not be you, but you are the one who can hear this, that you are the one who is aware. But in deep meditation, even awareness starts to fragment and disappear. And when consciousness goes, where the hell are you? You can find that out for yourself. Can consciousness create things? Are the five glassing groups a creation of consciousness? Haha, it's a very nice question. Consciousness does create things. Consciousness establishes the will. And from the will, you start creating the world. So, you are the creator. Even in quantum physics, they have this wonderful scientist here, the Schrodinger equation. The world, according to quantum physics, is just a smear of probabilities. Even where I am, the next moment, according to physics, there will be no law of physics broken if suddenly I disappear and manifest in Bodhinyana Monastery. That can happen, only it's highly unlikely. But it can happen. And it's called like just a smear of probabilities. And the only reason why an event happens is because when you make an observation, an experience, when consciousness gets involved, they say you collapse the Schrodinger equation. And you get an event. Life as we know it only happens when there's an observation. You know, they have that old philosophical question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it or to experience it, has it fallen? And quantum physics has answered that many years ago. It hasn't fallen. And it's not upright either. Both possibilities are still present until someone observes it. So it's in like a limbo state. It hasn't fallen, and it's not standing up. It's both. That's why quantum physics is really neat, because it just bends your mind to see things which are really weird. And I love weird stuff. So that's what consciousness is. Mention more later on. Yeah, go on. The universe evolves, yes. How do you mean there's no beings? Don't you believe in aliens? Wouldn't it be wonderful to have an alien come on the retreat? Now we've had Muslims, we've had Christians, and now we're at March for the alien. Don't you believe in creatures from outer space? There's one sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya of the Buddha which actually mentions beings living in other planets. It's only a very small sutra. But I read it, I thought, wow, the Buddha must be talking about aliens. Not aliens coming to visit, but he said in this 100,000-fold world system, there are other world systems with beings just like us. So there you go. Aliens exist according to Buddhism. It's fascinating. It's got nothing to do with meditation, but never mind. Now I've got the smallest question of all. Are karma, asavas, ego the same thing, the doer? I see what you mean. The karma is like there is, well actually karma really does mean like intended action of body, speech or mind. There is a doing. The asavas, these are the outflowings of the mind. You can experience these when you're meditating. Instead of staying inside, you go out to the sound, you go out to the future, you go out to your body, find out what's going on in your legs. It's when the mind can't stay at home and goes out into the world. That is part of doing. An ego, it's the karma, the asavas. It's actually the ego is what generates the karma, because you want to do something, it generates the intention, and it also, the intention actually makes the ego, makes it strong. So that's why big egos have big intentions and big wills, they really control freaks, and when they control it, it makes the ego even stronger. So the less you do, the smaller your ego. That's we become selfless, and selfless people are just kind. They don't try and control others. They're just generous. They don't keep things for themselves. They don't own things. So the more selfless you are, the more free you are. So they're pretty similar. And that's the last question for this evening. Plus a few jokes just to make the evening entertaining for you. And as you know, the night is still young. It's a Sunday, but you don't have to go to work tomorrow morning. So you don't have to go to bed early, thinking you have to get up early to go to work. You are free. So if you've got the energy, if you've got the inspiration, carry on meditating. If you're tired, then go to bed. Remember, when you go to bed, either do loving kindness meditation, or just letting be, or just sweep the body, and then you go and have a very, very nice rest. And don't have to worry what time you get up in the morning. Even, you don't even need to set your alarm clock. I'm sure you'll all get up by 7 o'clock when the breakfast is. 6 o'clock chanting, maybe uncertain, but 7 o'clock, absolutely certain you'll be up by that time. So have a nice evening and have a good rest. Because remember, this is still the early part of the meditation retreat, so you don't need to put forth much effort yet. You still need to catch up on rest. Take it easy, be gentle, and good night.